The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 18. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hi, everyone. How's everybody doing this evening? Looter 92. What would happen if the Colombian peso were pegged to the U.S. dollar? How can the U.S. compete when there are so many third world countries whose currencies constantly depreciate? How can the U.S. compete? Oh, you're assuming that the exports get a lot better because the currency goes down? You got to understand, when a currency goes down, there's a give and take. Your exports might be a little bit easier. I think it makes them less competitive, personally. But your imports become more expensive, depending on if you're a net importer or exporter. I don't know that there's a big advantage. I mean, if there's a huge advantage to countries whose currencies constantly depreciate, Venezuela would be the richest country in the world, right? So I think that's kind of a Keynesian type of fallacy, that the more you can depreciate your currency, the more robust your exports will be. To a certain extent, yes, but I don't think that's all that goes into it. Tony, thank you for the super chat. How long have you been flipping houses? Is that how you became a millionaire at the age of 38? Well, to be clear, Tony, I was actually a millionaire at the age of 34. Don't want to toot my own horn, but, you know, got to set the record straight there, buddy. I actually retired at the age of 38, and that is not how I made any of my money or retired. In fact, in 2012, when I hung it up as an entrepreneur, I had never owned a piece of property in my life. Never. I always rented or leased. And the first properties I purchased were at the tax auction in the property tax auction in Kansas City. This was August 2012. And the very first day I bought six houses, and it's kind of a baptism by fire. But short answer is no, I'd never owned a piece of property prior to that. I just, I came to real estate through studying macro in 2012. And that's a long story, but that's how I kind of, in fact, it was the chart. The kicker for me was a chart of the real estate crash in Japan in the early 90s. And that's, I kind of laid that over the chart of the U.S. And that's how it kind of, that was a light bulb moment for me right there to really start diving into real estate. I want to remind everyone about the Rebel Capitalist Show podcast. Sebastian's been working really hard on uploading those to iTunes and Stitcher, whatever your favorite podcast platform is. What we do is we take the interviews that I do on the weekends, like Luke Groman. And if you guys haven't seen that full-length interview, came out Saturday morning, you have got to see it. It is absolutely amazing. At the end of the live stream, if you got a little time, shoot over to the channel and watch that. I think you're going to love it. Okay, we've got another super chat from a Google user. Do you think there will be a reset, an overnight repricing of gold? And what's your best guess on a ballpark time frame? I don't think there's going to be an overnight repricing of gold. I think you could see it. Well, it's still on overnight. I was going to say, I think you might be able to see an overnight repricing of the dollar, like a Plaza Accord 2.0, but it wouldn't be literally overnight. That would take, even in 1984 or 85, when they did that, from peak to trough, it took well over a year, if my memory serves me well, for the dollar to lose 50% of its value. Keep in mind, that didn't produce much inflation back in the U.S. It was more a devaluation in the FX markets relative to the German mark and the Japanese yen. So I don't know if gold would have I can't think of a probable situation where that would happen. Not to say that it's not possible, but I don't think it's probable. Steven, thank you for the super chat. Asks, should I take my precious metals out of a self-directed IRA and use some of the funds for a down payment on a rental? Supply limited right now in KC. Yeah, it is. It is getting, it's weird because when I first started doing these videos, I had just helped my sister buy some properties in Kansas City. And I knew that you could get a 1% RV ratio. And I mean, this was like, I don't know, 6 months ago, maybe not that long ago, but it was a lot easier than it even is now. It's really, it's great if you're an owner, but it sucks if you're a buyer. As far as taking the precious metals out of the self-directed IRA, I wouldn't sell all your precious metals, especially with gold. I like to have 10% insurance, but it really depends, Stephen. It depends on your personal situation. There's a lot of variables, and I can't just say there's a one size fits all. What I will tell you is you have to remember that you're buying an annuity. You're buying a stream of cash flow. That's how I would suggest looking at a rental property. So if you feel as though you need a stream of cash flow in the future more than you would need, and I don't know what percentage of your investable assets you have in precious metals, but let's say you've got more than 10%. If you think that you need that cash flow more than you need that additional percentage of precious metals, then I would say yes. But again, really depends on your personal situation. Tough time pronouncing this one. Is it Sudati? Oh, that's a guess. I apologize if that's way on the pronunciation. Thank you for the super chat. Asks, deficit to GDP. Tell us more about what to watch for. Well, I don't know if you saw my video the other day where we had a really good chart of the deficit as a percentage of GDP. And we're at a high point right now at 4.6, roughly 4.6% of GDP. In the past, we've never been at those levels unless we were in a recession. So juxtapose that to this narrative in the media and Trump's Twitter feed, where everyone's saying that the U.S. it's the best economy of all time, of history. Well, okay, how are we running trillion-dollar deficits, or how are the deficits at 4.6%, which we've never seen unless the U.S. economy is in a massive recession? And taking that a step further, then what does the deficit go to if the economy does go into recession? Because as we all know, the deficits increase dramatically in recessions. So if we're at 4.6 right now, we get a recession, that takes us up to 15. If that recession is the same type of recession as we had in 2009. The reason I say that is because the deficit went from 1% of GDP up to 10% of GDP in the last recession. So if you're someone like me that believes the next recession will be far worse than the last recession due to the amount of debt in the system, then you've got to believe that that deficit could very well go north of 15%. As far as what to watch for, I'm not sure. Maybe you're kind of trying to figure out how that would play into the dollar. I'm not quite sure your question there, but I would go back and reference that video and take a look at that chart, and I think that'll answer a lot of questions for you. All right, David, thank you for the super chat. In your opinion, is Columbia a decent bug out spot? I think so, because it can easily grow all of its own food. I mean, you're like in a Garden of Eden here. I mean, everything grows really well here. So it's not as reliant on other countries for imports as, say, like a United States. That said, I want to be very clear, guys. I like Colombia. I love spending time in Medellin, but I would never like settle down the way most people think in any country, because listen, Colombia is no panacea. The government is terrible here, like it is everywhere on planet Earth. I've never seen a government that I actually like. So now hopefully I'll find one. But my point is, although this may be a great bug out place, would I suggest you coming down here and becoming a resident? Well, maybe getting your residency visa through investment, but becoming like a tax resident, like living here full time? Maybe. It depends on your personal situation, but I think it's far superior to where you can spend 6 months of the year in XYZ country and 6 months out of that country in other places. Why is that? Because then you're never a tax resident of any country. And like Doug Casey says, if you're a tax resident of a country, the government now sees you as a dairy cow. And if it gets bad enough, they'll see you as a beef cow. And that's a quick plug because I'm interviewing Doug this Tuesday. So I'm really excited about that. And also I interviewed Rick Rule last week. I'll put that up for next week's Rebel Capitalist show. But I don't want to get off on a tangent here. The bottom line is, if I could just wave a magic wand and have an ideal, it would be spend time, pick out two or three countries that where you really like spending time, which you think would be great bug out places based on your parameters. That may be a Colombia, a Croatia, a Montenegro. Those are probably my three favorites. And then just, spend a little time there, get a lay of the land. And if you feel as though it's time to bug out, I would just rotate between the countries where I liked, where I enjoyed spending time the most. Hey, Cody, thank you for the super chat. Is a REIT a good investment compared to traditional stocks? I have been stacking silver here. Okay. I was wondering if I need to pick up the pace or relax for now. Thank you. Well, personally, Cody, I see silver as a more of a speculation than I do insurance. So it depends what portion of your portfolio you have allocated to speculation. So for me personally, and this is different for everyone, and this is not investment advice, this is what I do personally. I like 10% insurance, 10% in speculation, and then the other 80% in investments that pay me to own them. So I like REITs. I like the concept, but I don't like them as much as having the physical real estate, because there's a lot of variables and you've got a lot more, you're tied more to the market. And also you got other management, you got fees, I just like being in control of my own investments, and you're in no way control over a REIT. But would I like it better than, and again, it depends on what the underlying assets are of that REIT. If we're talking about strip malls, no, I'd almost rather own like Coca-Cola. If we're talking about like apartment complexes or like adult care homes, or I don't think they'd have residential, like single family. Maybe. I don't know if you can find a REIT with single family. But you've got to do some homework there to see what the underlying assets are. And then going back to your silver question, if you see silver like I do as a speculation, then it depends on how, if you've got 10% of your portfolio allocated to that or not. Tony, with the Corolla, I think it's Corona, isn't it, virus, might be a trigger for economic crisis or black flag. It's possible. I don't know that I would bet on that happening. I think we've got plenty other potential triggers out there, Tony, that are far more dangerous than a virus, such as 200 trillion dollars in off balance sheet debt, such as the repo market, in fact, if you want to get China specific, I think HSBC is a hell of a lot more, I think HSBC has a lot more risk to trigger a financial or an economic crisis than the coronavirus does. But it is scary. I mean, I totally get it. But my point is that I think there, like the repo market and other things that we talk about, those, I think the probability would be a lot higher for those to trigger something than something that most likely will be kind of like a SARS type event. Wally, thank you for the super chat. During hyperinflation, I know it's beneficial to get a long-term loan, but wouldn't that be a problem collecting rents? It really depends on a lot of things. Number one, it depends what type of property you have. If you've got a $500,000 property out at the lake and you're renting that for $400 a night on Airbnb, yeah, that's going to be a problem. If you've got a starter home, which, you know, $100,000, $150,000 property, buying that under the cost of construction, and it's in a great neighborhood with great school districts, Are you going to have a tough time renting that out? No, no. Initially, and let me be clear. Initially, no. In fact, it would be quite the opposite, because as people kind of the people who could afford a $500,000 home now can afford a $300,000, now can afford $100,000. That there's going to be your renter pool there, and because people can less afford to get a mortgage to buy a house, well, then that could put upward pressure on rents, which it did from 2009 to 2012. If you look at a chart of rents, even adjusted for inflation, they went up as real estate was going down. That said, if you get a prolonged depression like the 1930s, and why I mean prolonged, I mean more than like 3 or 4 years, then yes, I would agree. Even with a starter home, you could see downward pressure on rents, because I think people would change their behavioral patterns, where right now everyone wants their own space. I think if they were economically forced into a situation where the only way they could afford to put a roof over their head if you get more people living in the same square footage, then it's basically like having a population decrease. And that's the fly in the ointment to rental properties. Yeah, that's really your biggest downside risk, is if you have a decrease in the population of that particular city, i.e. Detroit. So that's and by people changing their behavioral patterns, even if the population isn't decreasing, it's having the same net effect. So it really depends on what you see happening, right? If you see this as a really sharp recession like we had in 2009, I wouldn't worry about it at all. As long as you're buying the right property, let me be clear. If you're buying a condo in LA or Vancouver, Canada, then no, forget it. But again, starter home, linear market, good area, great school district, I think you're okay, unless we go into an extended type of depression like the 1930s. Rhoda, thank you for the super chat. Trump is talking about cutting taxes again. Would that be helicopter money we've been warned about? What would helicopter money look like? I definitely don't think that's the type of helicopter money I'm talking about, or Eric Townsend talks about on Macro Voices, that type of MMT, because you got to remember 50% of Americans don't pay taxes. Like maybe, let me rephrase that. 50% of Americans don't pay income taxes. So, I mean, if you're making 50 grand a year as a household and you got 2 or 3 kids, you're not paying tax. So the income tax doesn't affect, well, it doesn't affect as many people as you would probably need to get that velocity really humming like it would with MMT. So again, he's probably cutting corporate taxes maybe, or he's bringing the rate down on the, if you're making over like 200, 300, 400 grand. And I don't see that having a big inflation shock to the economy. I think that's where you're going with that question. So that's how I'd answer it. I think the helicopter money will be in the form of MMT directly to the people, in the form of bailing out pensions, UBI. I think it'll look something like that. I don't think it's really going to be through tax cuts. Kaiser, thank you very much for the super chat. Hey, it's 1 a.m. right now and I'm in France. Thank you for watching. And I have to go to sleep, but I'm just passing by and thank you for all your videos and educators. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And I appreciate you staying up really late on probably a work night and watching the live stream. Ian, thank you for the super chat. If you only want to store value, isn't silver better than gold because lower confiscation risk? And also has always been a store of value. Yeah, but it's got more industrial components to it, Ian. So it's gonna fluctuate quite a bit more. And it's really like supercharged gold. So it goes down a lot further and it goes up a lot more. And I'd really encourage you to watch the interview next Saturday that I post with Rick Rule, because I discuss this specifically with Rick. And obviously, he knows a hell of a lot more about it than he's forgotten more about it than I'll ever know. And but I talked to him about that gold silver ratio and the, like, silver versus gold and how he sees it. And he brought up some incredible, incredible points. So I'd really encourage you to watch that. And I think you'll get a tremendous amount of value from it. But just the way I see it, I just see gold is the ultimate hedge. It's the ultimate store of value. Geo Rob, thanks for being here, buddy. I sure appreciate all your support. It's really unbelievable that anyone would really. It's kind of shocking to me every time I look at my YouTube channel that anyone would want to hear me rant on for even one video, let alone every week. So I appreciate everyone a lot. And even, you know, I really appreciate people taking time out of their schedule to watch the videos and to comment. And it's really awesome. And I appreciate it, and so does the rest of the team. All right, George, thanks again for all the constant great content. As things get more volatile in the world, would you ever increase your gold holdings to 15 or 20%, or would you prefer to purchase additional real estate for rentals? It really depends on your personal situation. And if you've got enough, let's say you had $5 million in just liquid assets, and you had a very simple, I mean, you're never going to spend that much, right? And even invested at like a 5% interest rate or yield, that's plenty of cash flow for your personal situation. And if you're that person, then yeah, I would go higher than 10%, because it is all about capital preservation. I mean, 100%. But if you're someone that needs a return and that can't live out the rest of your life based on your current savings by getting no return, then I think it's better around 10%. Me personally, I like it at 10% just because I know real estate so well. And for me, it's a game that, and I've got teams in place. So, and I'm doing it outside the United States. I'm doing it in different countries. So for me, 10% is perfect. But yes, I definitely think that there's a situation for someone's individual circumstance where over 10% in gold would be more appropriate. All right, Matthew, thank you for the super chat. If you had 200 or 300 grand income, could you put into investments in 6 months? Where would you put it? Love your videos, by the way. So Matt, I'm not sure if you're asking if you had 200 or 300 grand just saved up, or you're making 200 or 300 grand a year. Income would imply that you're making that much a year that you could put into investments in 6 months. It's pretty much the same formula, Matt. I'd make sure you got 10% in insurance. Depending on how much you like or dislike real estate, I'd have a good chunk of it there in cash flowing real estate. If you didn't like that, I'd try to look for some dividend paying stocks, most likely outside of the United States, where you could get good cheap cash flow. And then I'd speculate. And to define what speculation means, that means you're buying something in hopes that it's going to go up. That's the only reason you're buying it. So maybe a speculation for you would be Bitcoin. Maybe a speculation for you would be the stock market, or maybe like Tesla. I mean, I don't like that as a speculation, but maybe you do. Keep in mind, Brent Johnson, Luke Groman, and Stan Druckenmiller, all three really, really smart guys, they think that the market's going up. In fact, Russell Napier, if you guys listen to Thursday night's Macro Voices episode, he also thinks the stock market could go up higher. So for me personally, just because I think something's going higher, that's not a reason for me to buy it, although I'd still consider that a speculation. For me, even on the speculative side, I only want to buy something if it's cheap. But that's not everybody. So there could be an argument there. But again, I'd make sure that it's only a small percentage of the portfolio. So if it goes against you, it's not affecting you too much. Baxter, thank you very much for the super chat. During the GFC, gold didn't go up that much in value. Why would it go up higher in the next coming recession? Okay. So again, I don't want to look at gold as buying it to go up. I just want to make sure that I can buy the same amount of stuff in 5 years with that gold as I can buy now, as I could have bought 50 years ago. So I kind of turn that around and say it didn't go up much in value, but everything else, as far as assets, plummeted in value. So although gold didn't really go down in dollar terms, relative to all the stuff that you can buy with your gold, gold went up huge. I mean, compare gold to the price of the S&P, or compare gold to housing. And that's why I buy gold. So I just see it a different way, Baxter. Now, silver, I might see differently, or Bitcoin, or a speculation. But if you're looking straight at gold, I'd strongly suggest looking at it the same way I do. Tony, thank you for the super chat. Says Schiff said he was given Bitcoins amounting to $2,000. Yeah. All of a sudden, access was denied with no recourse or retrieving his funds. Yeah, but listen, first of all, I love Peter. I think he's fantastic. I would love to interview him. He's been a huge influence on me. I listen to his podcast all the time. But if you read his tweet thread on that, it didn't get denied. It got denied just because Peter thought, like, he made a mental error. He thought that the password was like the username, or so, like he got them mixed up. So it was more of an error on Peter's side. I don't want to throw him under the bus, but we got to call a spade here. So he had no problem retrieving his funds once he figured out that his username wasn't his password. Okay, Joaquin gave me a sticker. Thank you, Joaquin. For those of you who don't know who Joaquin is, he is my general contractor, my architect extraordinaire. He is the leader of the team, and I've got to give him and his wife, Angie, 100% of the credit for any of the remodels. If you guys watched the little vlog we put up today, we had a lot of positive comments on, you guys loved the way we did the apartments and how they looked, or the gold apartment. You love the way they're looking. If you like that, well, don't compliment me. You got to compliment Joaquin and Angie. They're the ones that make that dream a reality. All right, Baxter, thank you for the super chat. Follow up: why not just hold cash rather than gold? If gold remains at 1500, but things plummet in value, why not just keep 1500 in cash? Because that 1500 in cash, Baxter, you are losing money every single year because we've got negative real interest rates. So if you're holding that in the bank and getting 0% interest, and inflation is running at 3% per year, you're losing 3% of the purchasing power of that cash while you're waiting for everything to plummet. That's not to say that you shouldn't hold some cash. I absolutely 100% agree that you should. I would prefer keeping it in short-term T-bills than in the bank, because you've got a lot less counterparty risk, and you're getting paid a little bit of interest, let's call it 1.8%, to subsidize the loss against inflation. So I would much prefer to do that. But again, it's weird, because people get very binary when they look at gold. Like, if it's either all or nothing, like I'm going to go 100% into gold or nothing into gold. And I just don't see it that way. I see it as different shades of gray. And I think 10% in gold is great. If you think you'd like to keep a lot of dry powder, maybe out of the 80% that you would have kept or allocated to investments, maybe I just put that into T-bills. Maybe you put your 10% speculation into T-bills because you're speculating that the market is going to get a heck of a lot cheaper than it is right now, and you're going to be able to buy at a lower price. But I don't see it being a one or the other thing. I see it being a both. Okay, question from Real P&L, Profit and Loss. I live in Fresno, California. How do I know if I live in a linear, hybrid, or cyclical type of market? I'd look at your RV ratios first and foremost. If you've got an RV ratio of like 0.5 or lower, you're probably not in a linear or a hybrid market. You're most likely in a cyclical market. And I'd try to find charts of your local area going back as far as I could, adjusted for inflation, and look at those charts, see how high it goes, how low it goes. I'd go back to and try to pull data from 2009 and through 2012 and see how much it went down and how high it's gone back up. I would be pretty surprised if there was anywhere in California that I would consider a linear market, but I could be wrong. And but you just do the homework on the RV ratios and then try to get a chart going as far back as you can of prices adjusted for inflation, and also of if you can find it, like a price to income chart, that would be ideal. Okay, Woo Ollie, thank you again for another super chat. Asks, I've heard gold futures is leveraged somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 to 1. Are investors that naive, or are they rigging the market? It's a casino at the end of the day. The financial economy has gotten so enormous, and it's really taken over the real economy to the extent that just everyday normal people, I think, look at the stock market and they look at the financial economy, and then they look at the type of return that they could get by maybe improving themselves, by starting a business, buying a franchise, doing something constructive with their money. And they just look at the financial economy, and it's so tempting that they put all their money there. This was not the way it worked prior to us going off the gold standard. And it would not be like this if we weren't in a fiat currency system where the Fed could increase its balance sheet by $4 trillion and M2 could increase by 50% in a matter of 10 years or whatever it's been. So because the financial economy has gotten so huge, it's a casino. It is. And if you're a gambler, you're going to want as much leverage as you can get. And if there are people out there that want that type of leverage, I promise you that investment banks are going to figure out a way to give it to them. For all, thank you very much for the super chat. For all asks, Great Depression or Mad Max? I'd have to go with Great Depression. I do think that this bug out, if the grid goes down, it could get very bad very quickly. I don't know that you see a Mad Max type situation, because if we look at Argentina, if we look at Venezuela, it's not like there's never been a country that's gone through a bout of massive inflation, huge deflation or hyperinflation, and you don't get that that Mad Max scenario. It's not to say that it couldn't happen for a few months. If the grid goes down in the U.S. and there's no food in the grocery stores, and I mean, yeah, that could get pretty crazy. I mean, look what happened when a hurricane goes through, or you know, you've got some natural disaster. They just loot all the stores, and I would see that as Mad Max. But I don't know that long term it would play out that way. So I would put my money on, if I had to choose one of the two, I'd put my money on a great depression. And that said, the Great Depression can be an inflationary depression. Let's not forget that. Hey, Tyler, thank you for the super chat. Asks, in your opinion, how would a wealth tax affect a small-time real estate investor? Boy, I really dislike a wealth tax. It's just such a bad idea. Initially, Tyler, it probably wouldn't affect you too much if you're talking about Elizabeth Warren's 1% or 2% or whatever she's trying to get on 50 million and above. In my opinion, though, it's just a matter of time before that goes from 50 million to 5 million to 1 million to 500,000. It's just the natural course of taxes. Look at the income tax when that first started. That was just for the rich, just for the rich. And then 5 years later, everybody's paying it or whatever. You know, it's very, I don't know if it's 5 years, but within a short period of time, almost everyone was in that income tax world. So, and look at how broke the government is. And look at the political narrative on the left. Don't get me wrong. I don't like the right. I don't like the left. They're all crooks. If you think about what it takes to be a good politician, think that one through, right? To be a good politician, you've got to be morally bankrupt. And that's just the honest truth. So, and it doesn't matter whether you're on the left or the right. That's what it takes to be a good politician. So I don't want to make it seem like I'm picking on the left. I hate all politicians equally. Let me just preface with that. But I don't think that a wealth tax would affect you right away. But within 10 years, I think it's probably going to affect you. I think what could affect you faster than that would be an increase in the property taxes. Because with the pension crisis that so many of these states have and these gaping holes in their pension funds, I think that's where they're going first and foremost, is upping property taxes. Tony asks, I'm curious, bacteria won't live on silver, so can silver purify water? Tony, I have no clue, buddy. I don't even want to venture a guess on that. I'm not sure. Thank you for the super chat, though. Jonathan asks, thank you, Jonathan, for the super chat. Is it safe to hold 30-year treasuries in the context of an all-weather portfolio like Dalio's, where one simply rebalances if a particular asset class crashes? No, I don't like that, Jonathan, because that whole mentality of rebalancing portfolios and that advice that you get from financial advisors assumes that the stock market, there's an inverse correlation between the stock market and the bond market. It's not true. Not true. Look at the last 10 years. Stocks and bonds are at all-time highs. So if they can go up at the same time, in my opinion, they can go down at the same time. And these financial advisors aren't factoring that into the advice that they're giving the average Joe. And it's really unfortunate that, I mean, most of the financial advisors, I mean, come on, they're just salespeople. They don't, and no offense to any financial advisors out there. I mean, sure, there's a ton of really, really good ones, but I don't think most of them really have any idea what's going on as far as the macro environment that we all live in. I think that the majority of the people that watch my channel have a much better understanding of the reality of the world economy and the U.S. economy than a normal financial advisor would. So anyway, I don't want to throw them under the bus. But my point is that if they can go up in tandem, they can go down in tandem. So I don't think that there's any benefit to rebalancing and just going, instead of doing 60-40, doing 50-50 or 70-30, I don't think that's really going to protect you that much in the next crisis. Raymond, thank you for the super chat, asks, looking at a house purchase, should I put down 3% and pay PMI or 20% down, not pay PMI, purchase around 250K? I'd have to do the math on the PMI, Raymond. I don't know that math right off the top of my head. I would look at, I always type this mortgage calculator into Google, and I think it takes me like mortgagecalculator.com is the one I always use. And you can just type in the PMI, do it over the span of the loan, assuming you're getting a 30-year fixed rate. I would just do that. But as far as 3%, like how much to put down, that really depends on your personal situation. If I had plenty of cash flow coming in and I knew that was never or most likely wouldn't be a problem on a moving forward basis, I would probably try to do a little less, but just because you'd be maximizing on any type of inflation that we get in the U.S. over the rate of interest that you're paying on that loan. And as we all know, and I'm sure most of you guys have heard me say a million times, that the only thing that I think is cheap in the United States is 30-year fixed rate mortgages. So if you can take advantage of as much of that as possible. Now, that said, I would not suggest someone doing like 10 or 15% down if you're just having to penny pinch in order to make that mortgage payment. Not a good idea. And that is not what I'm advising at all. But only if you're in a financial position where you're not going to really have to worry too much about making those monthly payments. Jason, thank you for the super chat. Is the repo reduction from $35 billion a week to $30 billion a week quantitative tightening? I'd have to look at the New York Fed's website to know exactly what you're talking about. I don't know if you're talking about the term repos. They're doing more than 35 a week or $30 billion a week. Maybe you're talking about the addition to their balance sheet when they're buying T-bills and their balance sheet was expanding. It depends if the repo reduction is a result of the borrowers taking back that collateral and paying back the Fed, or if it's really a matter of them decreasing their balance sheet from the $60 billion a month or so that they were purchasing and admitting to adding to their balance sheet. I'd have to look at those numbers to give an exact answer, Jason. But if you want, I would go to the New York Fed's website. They've actually got all the information right there. They're very upfront. They disclose everything. And you can just look right at the numbers and probably do some pretty easy math. Okay, Conrad, thank you for the super chat. I have the option of a VA home loan in California. Okay. Should I use it to start building equity or wait for the crash, possibly losing the option? Boy, it'd be great if you could take advantage of that VA loan, Conrad. That's a tough question. It really just depends on the RV ratios where you're looking to buy. If you're asking me, would you use a VA loan to buy a property in LA where you're getting that's negative cash flowing on a rental property? No, I wouldn't. You couldn't pay me to buy that. But if you're getting maybe a 0.8, if it's positive cash flow or 1%, maybe in a more rural area, I would consider it. I mean, I would rather buy outside of California just because you got so many headwinds there with rent control and property taxes and the income tax is just staggering in California. But if you only can buy in California, then that's what I would use as a guide. If you can't positive cash flow it, I'd wait. That's really the bottom line. Locust Nation, thank you for the super chat. It says, George, you rock. Thank you. Appreciate it. Yang plus UBI. Question, in order to shuffle that much fiat on top of existing U.S. economy, what would it look like to the U.S. economy? Okay, I'm assuming that you're talking about what would the Yang UBI look like for the economy? It would look like inflation. And one thing I want to point out, and there's a lot of people obviously that are really gung-ho on Andrew Yang and the UBI. And whenever I say I don't like his version of UBI, if you want to call it that, and everyone jumps on me and say, well, yeah, George, but that's because you don't get AI. You don't understand AI. You don't get it. You don't understand that all Tesla is going to have self-driving trucks. And no, I get it. I trust me, guys. I get it. What I don't get is why, if we have a UBI, we still need welfare. That's what Andrew Yang can't answer. So going back to Friedman, the whole reason he liked an idea of a UBI type system. I understand it wasn't exactly, there's different definitions there, but the reason he liked that system is because it would reduce the size of government. That's the whole key. Yang wants to increase the size of government. He doesn't want to do away with welfare. So people conflate the two. They think that because you don't like UBI or Yang's version of it, then that means that you just don't get AI. Well, no, it's just that let's just assume that we need UBI because of this AI wave that we're going to get in the future. Okay, fine. Okay, I can understand that argument. I might not agree with it, but I get it. Okay, but why do we need welfare? That's the question that Andrew Yang can't answer. And the reason is because he's just trying to buy votes. Let's just be honest here. He's trying to buy votes. He knows if he took away welfare and that the people that would have voted for him, most likely he'd lose a lot. And he's just in the same category as all the other politicians. I mean, let's call a spade a spade. I mean, I will grant him that he's got a better head on his shoulders from what I've heard than the rest of the people he's competing against. And he seems like a straightforward guy, but at the end of the day, he's just doing whatever he thinks he needs to do in order to get votes. And if he wasn't, he'd wipe out welfare. So anyway, but bottom line is for the economy, it would most likely result in inflation, and which really almost defeats the purpose of UBI, because if the price of goods and services is going up in the same amount of the UBI, then it's a net wash. But anyway, bottom line is probably mild inflation at the beginning, and which could result in more inflation, depending on how much velocity increased and how many dollars would come in from outside of the system because of that inflation risk concern. Tony, thank you for the super chat. Another question here. Thank you. Thank all your listeners for answering to my silver questions. Yes, silver purifies water. Okay, cool. See, these guys in the live stream or the live chat know a heck of a lot more than I do with a lot of these questions. Awesome. Thank you, everyone, for in the live stream for answering Tony's silver question. Josh asks, see another question here. Do money market accounts hold higher risk than normal accounts? Yes. Is a short answer. I know banks are terrible, but between real estate deals, I hold funds in money market accounts. Yeah, I mean, look, any time that you get an interest rate above what you would get on just a normal savings account, there has to be more risk. It's by definition. They're not going to be able to pay you a higher interest rate unless they're taking on more risk. And granted, with most of the money market accounts, they're most likely not putting them into the repo market. But once you get into the CDs and some of the money market funds, who knows where they're going? Who knows? And that's just too much counterparty risk for me. So that's why, obviously, you got to keep 5-10 grand in the bank to pay your bills and whatnot. But if I've got 500 in cash, I'm not keeping that in a bank account. I'm keeping that in short-term T-bills. AUAG, thank you for the super chat, asks, how about a quarter USD 4-week T-bills, okay? A quarter gold silver bullion, okay? Quarter NUGT, which I'm guessing is a minor ETF, and quarter in multifamily commercial real estate. It depends. Wow, that depends. I mean, what's multifamily commercial real estate? I like that. I think just for me personally, well, you've got a quarter in gold and bullion though. So I'd look at the NUGT, assuming that's a minor ETF as a speculation. Got a lot of T-bills in case of a rainy day. It depends on the size of the portfolio. Going back to that earlier question, if this is a $5 million portfolio and your monthly net to pay your personal expenses is $5,000 a month or something, then this could make sense, because although you've got a lot of speculation, you've got a lot of insurance, and then you've got a ton of dry powder, and then you've got some good cash flow coming in. Yeah, I mean, I don't think this is too bad. There's a lot of variables, but just looking at your little text right here, I would say you're doing pretty good. Jared, thank you very much for the super chat. Wouldn't physical silver be insurance plus speculation? Loving the Rebel Capitalist episodes. Thank you, Jared, for watching. Really appreciate it. And yeah, to a certain extent, I think it could be insurance plus speculation. Yeah, I think I could go with that. But I mean, the fact that it's speculative means that it's going to go up or down probably a lot more than good insurance would. So I just would keep it in my speculative bucket. I'm not saying that's right or wrong, guys. Whenever I'm saying any of this stuff about investing, I'm not saying that you have to go out and do it or else you're crazy. And I'm just telling you guys what I do personally, what I've thought through, what makes the most sense for my personal portfolio, and what I encourage my personal friends and family members to do. When my family, my sister, comes to me and says, "Hey, George, what should I do?" I literally tell her the exact same thing that I tell you guys on this live stream. Hey, Gregory, thank you for the super chat. Refinanced to buy a new home. Should I rent, sell my old home in Rapid City, South Dakota? Value went up a lot and would raise taxes if taxed on the gain and sold after 3 years, if not living it. Advice. Ooh, boy. Okay, let me try to think through this. So you refinance to buy a new home. So I'm guessing you refinance against the equity in your old home to buy the new home. So the first question is, should I rent or sell the old home? I think it just depends on how good of a rental property it would be. I'm assuming Rapid City is a pretty linear market, but I know a lot of the markets up in, maybe that was North Dakota, but in they were really tied to shale, weren't they? Maybe I'm thinking North Dakota. So I wouldn't want to be in a market like that was really tied to shale. But assuming that it's a linear market and you could get a 1% RV ratio on it, then yeah, I would definitely consider keeping it. And again, that's assuming you've got 30-year fixed rate mortgage on it. Then the next question is, value went up a lot. Okay, I'm assuming that's your old home, and would raise taxes. Oh, I see. So if you sold it, you'd have a big tax event because of the capital gains. Yeah, I'd hang on to it. If you're getting a great RV ratio in a linear market, why sell it? I think that's the best answer I can give you. Tobias asks, you know of Yaron Brook? I do. Appreciation from Denmark. Yeah, he runs the Ayn Rand Foundation. I don't know if it's a foundation, but the Ayn Rand Institute, maybe. Or at least he used to. And yeah, I think he's a smart guy. I really like listening to him. Whenever he's on a podcast, I always try to listen to it when I do have time. I focus more on the economics podcast, but if I've got a time to listen to like a Tom Woods show or more of a libertarian podcast, he'd definitely be someone that I like listening to. I'm not sure about his investing views, but as far as his views on personal liberty, capitalism, and I like what he says about that for sure. Firepower Joanne or Johan asks, thank you for the super chat, by the way. For how long can asset prices rise higher than the official inflation? What happens when it stops? Hyperinflation, asset crash, or currency default? That's a lot to unpack, my friend. That is a lot to unpack. Let me see if I can do my best here. Okay, so how long can asset prices rise higher? A long time. I mean, look at how high asset prices. Let's just look at the S&P going back to 1981. That said, we had an environment of going on 40 years now where interest rates have pretty much gone straight down. So I think that has more to do with it, interest rates, than the return or the increase in the S&P being above the official rate of inflation. So I don't know if there's a specific hard stop that, okay, if it's gone 10 years, then historically speaking, that's not good. It's most likely going to come down. The next question is, what happens when it stops? That really depends on why it stops. What's the catalyst? If we get MMT, we get some inflation, the Fed loses control of the long end of the yield curve, the corporate bond market crashes, you're going to see asset prices completely collapse in that type of environment. And then that could lead to hyperinflation, because then the Fed would most likely come in and just print, just an astronomical amount of money to try to prop things up. And if it didn't prop things up, if it, instead of going into the financial economy like it did for the last 10 years as a result of QE, if it actually somehow went right back into the real economy, and that prompted all of the dollars that are outside of the U.S. domestic economy, let's call it 20 trillion plus, if we go on what Jeff Snyder is saying, if a lot of that's coming home, oh my gosh, that could cause some serious, serious inflation. So unpack again, it's impossible for me to give you a specific answer because it would depend on the catalyst that would make it quote unquote stop. But I think that's just me going right off the cuff. That's probably the best answer I can give you. Hey, Lewis, thank you for the super chat. Asks, what do you think of doing leverage for gold? No, because that's not why I'm buying gold. I'm buying gold as an insurance policy. And I've said that quite a few times here, but it's important that we all understand that, or that you guys understand the way I see it. And I just would, if it's an insurance policy, I'm not going to lever it. And also, if I want a leveraged gold speculation, I'm just going to buy the miners, or I'm going to buy the juniors, or I'm going to buy silver miners. If you really want a leverage play on gold, speculate on the silver miners. I wouldn't just straight lever gold. Okay, thoughts on rolling tail hedge out of the money puts to capitalize on market corrections and implied volatility spikes. First and foremost, I'm not a trader, so I don't pretend to be one, even on YouTube. And I'm interviewing Patrick Serezna in, I think, a few weeks here. He's the co-host of the Macro Voices podcast, and this is his business. So I'm definitely going to ask him these types of questions. But if it's a pure speculation and you understand how to execute these trades very, very well, and very few people do, but if you're someone that feels really confident and your ability to execute these types of trades, as far as a speculation, yeah, I like it. When we're talking about volatility, I'm sure that you're buying, you can buy those money puts, whatever type of option that you're buying to express that trade, or whatever you're buying to express that trade, as far as a volatility trade, I'm guessing it's going to be really, really cheap right now, because I haven't looked at the VIX lately, but I'm was it probably around 10 now? Might even be in single digits, or well, maybe with what's going on with the Corona thing, it might be up by 15 or 18. I haven't looked at it, but I would guess that volatility is extremely low, therefore extremely cheap, especially when you consider all of the things that can kind of go wrong, all the black swan type of events that we could get. So I guess my short answer is, if you're just looking at it as a speculation, if you really understand how to execute that trade, which I think very few people do, then I think there could be some opportunity there. Archie, thank you for the super chat. Interested in income property with Jason Hartman, okay, 70,000, 85,000 range. What linear markets would be best handle the economic downturn? 25% down payment the best? What qualities and qualities in home neighborhoods attract quality tenants? Let me answer that last one first. School districts. In my experience, it is all about school districts. So I like to go into neighborhoods that are where all the young families want their kids to start and finish. I mean, from kindergarten to going all the way through high school. That's where they want to be. In Kansas City, that would be the Blue Springs School District is fantastic. And the Lee's Summit School District is just as good, if not better. In other markets, I'm not sure what the good school districts are, but that's where you want to start. As far as putting down 15, 20, 25%, it all depends on your personal financial situation. To be safe, you might want to do 25. You're just going to have less of a dollar short with the less leverage, or let me, I didn't say that very well. The more leverage you use, the more you're going to short the dollar through that fixed rate mortgage. So if you're putting up 25%, you're going to have more positive cash flow. And if a renter misses a payment here and there, you're probably not going to sweat it too much. But if you could take 15, that's a better way to short the dollar. It all depends on your personal situation and how easy you could cover that rent if you did go 2 or 3 months without a renter, or I'm sorry, how easily you could cover the mortgage payment without having a renter in there for a couple months. You got to assume that you're going to have a couple months of occupancy every year. As far as what linear markets, I would really ask Jason that one. He's done so much more homework than I have. And I know everything about Kansas City, but I don't know a lot about those other markets. So you got to know what you don't know. I would defer to Jason on that question. Jonathan, thank you for the super chat. Currently own bullion through BOA, who use company called GBI for precious metals, supposedly kept off bank's balance sheet, but who knows? Third party, a better option. Hard to sell without middleman bank. Okay, so a third party better option. I see what you're asking. For me personally, the best option is just digging a hole in my backyard and keeping it there. That's the best option for me with a portion of it. With the other portion, you're going to have third party risk, or you're going to have counterparty risk. So I suggest just storing it in a bunch of different locations, maybe not a bunch, but three or four different locations, political jurisdictions. So you just decrease your risk as much as possible. So maybe keep 10% buried in your backyard, and then the other 80-90%, whatever, just in other jurisdictions, and just kind of diversify there. That's what I would do. And I want to point out one thing here. It's because you're talking about selling it. And I'm not sure if you're talking about selling the gold you currently have or selling it in the future, but gold to me is something that you would rarely want to sell. So I wouldn't be too fixated on that. Neurosurgery Highland, thank you very much for the super chat. Asks, how do you buy short-term T-bills and what do you do when they expire? You roll them over and you can buy them directly from the government on Treasury. It's Treasury. I forgot the website. It's right on their website. So if you just Google it, it'll pop right up. Charles asks, please discuss the long-running silver suppressions in the U.S. Will it ever stop? I think at some point in time, well, I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to as far as the silver suppressions. Are you talking about the market being manipulated? If so, I don't have a lot of experience. I haven't done too much research on that. If it's being manipulated, then will it stop? At some point, I think it will, because I think gold's going to go up a lot. And when gold goes up a lot, I think silver is going to, like always, most likely go up even more. Now, again, that's not to say that I think it's insurance. It's more of a speculation to me. But yeah, I think it'll definitely spot. Because at a certain point, guys, we all have to remember that the market is stronger and more powerful than any central bank. And I know it seems really hard to believe that because of all of the funny money that's been printed and the control over the yield curve and the repo market and all this intervention from central banks. And it seems like they have control. They don't. They don't. And now they can have control temporarily. I absolutely for sure. But in the long run, the market will always have the final say. And that's regardless of whether it's the bond market or the precious metals market. John, thank you for the super chat. Timing for interest rates and inflation. Fed will keep low to zero or less as long as possible. How long before it hits the fan? Natural order takes over. As far as timing, I would look for MMT. Because you've got to look at the velocity and the money supply in the real economy expanding and getting more rapid. That's going to be your first indication. Okay, now I need to start looking at this. Another thing, you're talking about the Fed will keep it low, zero or less. That's right. But we've got to realize that the Fed doesn't have that much control over the long end of the yield curve. They could drop rates to negative. And the 10-year could still be at 7%. You just have a super steep yield curve. And a lot of people are probably saying to themselves, oh, well, yeah, George, but they can just print the money to buy bonds. Right, but look at QE. What was QE? QE is when they bought 10-year, or they bought the long end of the yield curve to try to bring those rates down. Well, every single time they expanded their balance sheet, to buy the long end of the yield curve and to create more demand for those treasuries, which should have brought interest rates down. What did interest rates do? They actually went up. So I'm not saying it's impossible for the Fed to print enough money to bring the long end of the yield curve and to kind of manhandle the long end of the curve, but they would have to print a hell of a lot more than the $4.5 trillion, or roughly, that they printed in QE1, 2, 3, and 4, now if you want to call the repo market QE4, if history tells us anything. Now, I understand that history doesn't repeat itself exactly, but it rhymes quite a bit. And we could find a situation where once they expand the balance sheet, then the market says, you know what, we're done with this. We are done with this. We see inflation. And then you could, or you could have, they could expand the balance sheet and we could have so much capital flight come in that you could see interest rates go down. There's a lot of these cross currents that go on. And that's why it's so hard to predict, because it's such a complex system. But if I'm putting my money on it, just looking at charts of what's happened in the future, when the Fed increases their balance sheet to a certain degree, it's gonna drive, have the tendency to drive rates higher. So the whole point is that the Fed doesn't have or has very little control over that long end. And let's admit, they lost control of the short end. I mean, let's not forget that when repo spiked on September 17th, that took Fed funds rate out of the target. So if you recall, the target rate, the high end of their target September 17th was 2.25, well, or 225 basis points, in other words. Well, the Fed funds rate went up to 2.3 or 230 basis points. It went above their target. So technically, they lost control over the short end of the yield curve. So it's not only possible for them to lose control of the long end, it's now what we've seen, it's very possible for them to lose control over the short end of the yield curve. And if you really want to think about a economic catastrophe, try thinking that one through. If the Fed loses control over the short end, which according to the repo market should be at 10%, and they lose control over the long end, that would get ugly really, really fast. And if you go back to the interview that I did with Luke Grohman, we discussed this, and Luke believes that not only would that bring down the U.S. economy, but it would most likely bring down the economies in the entire developed world. So that's, I don't want to say that's going to happen or it's going to happen tomorrow, but it's something we all need to be cognizant of, that the Fed isn't control over the market. At the end of the day, the market is more powerful. Geo Rob, thank you for the super chat. Are you firm on the 1% RV ratio for a rental? No, I'm not. I like to use that as a target, but realistically, especially if prices and even these linear markets keep going up like this, you're not going to be able to do it unless you go into a neighborhood where I would not want to go. So to stay in a good neighborhood, I would much prefer a 0.8 RV ratio or even a 0.7 than going into the ghetto and trying to get a 1% RV ratio. So yeah, I would have some flexibility there, Rob. Yeah, and if you're dropping $130 and getting $1,200 a month in rent, as long as you've got plenty of positive cash flow as a buffer, I would consider that for sure. Okay, Brennan asks, what's to prevent a race to the bottom of other currencies if the USD collapses? What's to prevent it? I don't know that it's not a possibility that we could have, especially the yen, the euro, and the dollar. I mean, look at how much debt areas, jurisdictions have. I mean, my goodness. So I think you could see that. I could totally see them all coming down at the same time, because every one of these currencies is horrible. In that case, gold goes to the moon, but I think it's definitely possible for sure. Okay, question from Robert. I bought about a $300,000 house 2 years ago. Okay. 10 years. I have 10 years plus before paying it off. Okay. Do you think it's wise to sell now before the collapse, rent it out instead? Lease purchase agreement. I wouldn't do a lease purchase agreement. Again, Robert, I don't know the market you're in. I don't know what type of rents you can get. I don't know if you'd be cash flow positive on it. I just don't know, buddy. I can't give you an answer. I mean, if you're in a great market, I would probably I'd probably rent it out. But then it depends on the rest of your portfolio. I mean, how much gold do you have? How much do you have in speculation? What's your monthly nut? I can't answer that question. It's just there's too many variables. And sorry about that, Robert. I wish I could. Maybe if you guys have a question like this in the future, make sure you tell me where the property is. And if you by chance know kind of the general RV ratios, that would help me out a lot. Okay. Hi, Viz Economist. Thank you for the super chat. Asks, Nikkei down 2% and Shanghai down 3% on open. Somebody sure is taking the virus seriously. Yeah. Yeah. Oil took a dump as well. Yeah. We'll have to see where it goes. A lot of times those are kind of knee-jerk reactions, but it seems like this virus is getting worse. It's moving over to the United States. I read today, I think on Twitter, Danielle DiMartino Booth said that there was now 5 cases in the United States. Most of the time, these things turn out to be almost a buying opportunity. But do you really want to take the risk that this time it's a lot worse? I just don't really pay much attention to stuff like that because that's not the way I invest. I'm not a trader. I'm not trying to capitalize and just make a quick 5 or 10%. It's hard for me to really have an investment opinion on that. But yeah, for sure, they're definitely taking it seriously. And hopefully this thing will phase itself out kind of like the SARS did. Cody asks, George, can you foresee the fiat system lasting 5 more years? Yeah, for sure, Cody. For sure, for sure. These things go on way, 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 way longer than you think they ever could. It goes back to that old saying, the market can remain irrational a lot longer than you can remain solvent. And it's, I can absolutely, I would most likely assume that it will last that for sure. Okay, let me take a couple more questions, guys. So Cole asks, do you have any knowledge regarding the Canadian housing market? Any predictions or forecasts that you may have or general insight? It's expensive. It's in a bubble. And if I had equity in the Canadian housing market, I would be selling that and taking that equity and moving it somewhere more friendly. That's really the bottom line. And could the market double from here? Sure, absolutely. But remember, that's not the way you invest. At least that's not the way I suggest investing. The very first rule is you ask yourself, is it cheap? Is it expensive? If it's cheap, you buy it. If it's expensive, you sell it. It doesn't matter if it doubles from there. It doesn't matter if it goes up another, whatever, fill in the blank. As long as you do that over the long run, you're going to come out ahead. If you sit there and try to guess tops and bottoms and all these things, you're just, in my opinion, although you may get it right every once in a while, in the long run, you're going to lose. Oh, this is a good question. DeMayan 5 asks, talking about RV ratio, do you monitor that after buying and use it as a selling signal if the value gets too high? Yes. I think that's a really good point. If you buy at a 1% RV ratio and prices go to the moon and now they're at a 0.5 or 0.4, I think that's a great sign that you should be hitting the bid and then taking that equity and moving it elsewhere. I think that's a really good point. Great insight there. What if it's not cheap or expensive, but fair value? I'm assuming you're talking about a real estate. And if it's fair value, historically speaking, based on strictly the price, but you're getting good cash flow, then yeah, I think it's something worth considering. Because we've got to remember that when we're buying real estate, at least the way I like to buy it, you're buying cash flow. Even if you want to flip it, I still start with cash flow. So you're buying an income stream. And if you can buy an income stream that's solid at a fair price or a fair value, historically speaking, I don't think it has to be cheap, because you're just the asset that's backing it. You don't care if it goes up or down in price, as long as you're getting that cash flow. It's got, like Jason says, he says this very well. I totally agree with him. The investment has to make sense from the day you buy it. And if it does, then you're not planning on selling. So if it goes up or down, you don't really care. Jeff asks, smart to take a loan to buy an overpriced shack in California, even if you could pay all cash or pay all cash. Oh my gosh, don't pay all cash. No. I don't know why you're trying to buy an overpriced shack in California. I'd suggest maybe renting that shack in California and buying somewhere else where it was a better investment. But you definitely don't want to go all in with cash. No, I wouldn't do that. Right. So Robear Network, he says, Yang said Americans can choose between welfare and UBI. Yes, that's the problem. That's my point. That is my point. That just shows that he's not understanding, or he just chooses not to admit to understand or to knowing why Friedman wanted or proposed something like a UBI, whatever you want to call it, a negative income tax, UBI. It's because it would reduce the size of government. So if you're allowing people to choose between welfare or a UBI, you're increasing the size of the government. The exact opposite of the reason that Friedman would preach or would was a proponent. I think that might even be too strong of a word, but was friendly to the idea of a UBI type system. Oh, well, here's Richie asks, should I pay 45K student loan or put 20% down on a house? I wouldn't pay off the loan. This may sound crazy, and I don't want to suggest, I don't want this to be construed as advice, but let me just tell you what I would do if it was my personal situation. There is no way I would pay off a student loan, because let's just say there's even a 10% chance that thing gets wiped out. I'd be kicking myself for paying off that student loan if in, say, 2021, it's all the debt's forgiven. I'm not gonna pay it. Or, I already paid it. Too bad. So, I mean, you can't go back to them and say, oh, shoot, but that's not fair. I just paid this off 2 weeks ago, and now all of a sudden you wipe the slate clean. They're going to say tough luck. So now that said, if this 20% down is 20% down on a house in San Francisco, that may be a little different. But yeah, I'd strongly suggest keeping that 45 grand in student debt, just making the minimum payments till at least 2021, or at least till the election, and then kind of go from there. Okay. All right, guys, I'm going to sign off right now. And just as a reminder, make sure you check out the podcast. Go to iTunes or Stitcher and type in The Rebel Capitalist Show. It'll pop right up. You can subscribe and you can listen to the audio of all the live streams or the amazing interviews that we do. Next week, we've got Rick Rule. And this Tuesday, I'm interviewing Doug Casey. So we'll see you guys on tomorrow's video.
Thank you for listening to The Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.